where there's always been a fear that those who consume Gothic narratives will not be able to distinguish between the Gothic fantasies and reality and will somehow lose themselves in that imaginative process. And that's something that continues even to today, you know, in discourse about violence in the media, in horror films and video games, that, you know, first-person shooter games, for example, that the consumer won't be able to differentiate between what's fiction and what's real. And the violence and the horrors in Gothic will desensitize them to real horrors.
That's Natalie Neal. She's a professor at York University who teaches English and specializes in all things Gothic, with a particular specialty in parodies. Now, we brought her in to talk about Gothic fiction for a recent piece that we did in Built to Play 58, but I really like this interview, so I think I'm going to hold on to it and show you the whole thing. If you want a good history of all things Gothic fiction, I recommend you stay tuned and enjoy. Gothic means a lot of different things depending on the context, even within literature. What are some of the origins of Gothic fiction and what makes the genre unique historically?
That's a really good question. Gothic, I would define Gothic as literature, fiction of horror, terror, and mystery. And it originated in the 18th century in England during the Enlightenment period. And it's very much a reaction against Enlightenment values. So whereas the Enlightenment thinkers were placed a lot of importance on rationality and intellect and order, the Gothic narratives were wild, imaginative tales that explored the things that science and reason couldn't explain. So they also focus on imagination and the extreme emotions of characters. And we see a sort of an evolution of Gothic from the earliest tales, which tended to be historical novels set in foreign medieval places. And of course, the primary setting is the Gothic castle with all the architectural trappings of subterranean passageways through which the persecuted heroine is chased by the villain, trapdoors, secret chambers, and ghosts, and so on. But as we move through the 19th century into the present day, Gothic tales tend to be set in the present world, and so the Gothic horrors come closer to home.
What are some of the ties to Romanticism early on? What kind of relationship does the Gothic play with the Romantic era?
Gothic is sometimes described as dark Romanticism, and I think the Romantic writers, the Romantic poets and novelists were concerned with a lot of the same themes. So again, they place emphasis on the emotions and the imagination as opposed to reason and science, and concerned with exploring the complex emotions of characters. And of course, the Gothic novelists want to evoke a strong emotional response from their readers as well.
So how does then horror get tied into the Gothic?
Well, I called Gothic literature of horror and terror, and those are two distinct things. Terror is a sort of a nameless dread, an uncertainty, an ambiguity in the text. And horror, instead, is the direct presentation of something shocking and violent. So we see both of those things in Gothic novels. You know, through suspense, we have terror of the characters within the story, and also and that reads as uncertainty for those who are following along, the readers. And then horror in the depiction of the grotesque and dreadful monsters and, you know, bloody corpses and violence and so on.
What are some of the highlights of then the Victorian Gothic?
Like I said, in the Victorian period, we see the horrors and terrors moving closer to home. So they're given settings that are more familiar to, you know, the readers. And this makes the stories potentially more frightening because they take on a greater, one might say, realism or plausibility. So the stories aren't set in the Gothic barbaric past, but instead the settings are more familiar.
What's a good example of what's an exemplary member of the Victorian Gothic era?
I would say the Brontes, an excellent example of, you know, Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Stevenson later in the century, and of course Bram Stoker's Dracula. But there are a plethora of different, you know, subgenres even within Victorian Gothic. There are werewolf tales and vampire stories and so on.
Wuthering Heights, at least contemporarily interpreted, would not be considered really a horror, but how does it fit then into terror and the Gothic themes?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's a different kind of Gothic, one that's more concerned with the experience of the... Well, it's more focused on sort of the horrors of human behavior. And I'm thinking about, you know, Heathcliff as the Byronic hero who's, you know, really, he's the romantic hero. Kathy loves him, but he's really quite a despicable human being. So it's an example of the dreadful things that human beings are capable of. And that, you know, links back to earlier Gothic, for example, texts like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, where you also have, you know, exploring the idea of the beast within. Very popular in Victorian literature, of course, because of Darwin's theories and this idea that, you know, Darwin introduced in Origin of the Species the idea that, of course, human beings evolved through the process of natural selection from primitive forms. And that raises the specter of the possibility of devolution, that, you know, human beings, if they can evolve, they can also sort of degenerate into a more beastly state. And I think werewolf stories really capture that fear.
There's also that separation from man from the rest of the animals, that we are kind of no better than them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then in the early 20th century, we do get H.P. Lovecraft. Who is this guy and how does he kind of make his mark on the genre?
Lovecraft is a hugely important American fantasy and horror writer. He published a lot of his stories in a pulp fiction magazine called Weird Tales. And indeed, his stories are very weird, very strange. And he likes to focus on bizarre matters and creatures. He's a mythopoeic writer, which means that he's created his own mythology that's centered on it's called the Cthulhu mythology, centered on this figure of a strange underwater awe-inspiring demon Cthulhu, but all sorts of other strange monsters and cosmic entities and bizarre figures. And he's very, very interesting figure because in many ways we see a complete departure in his work from, you know, the Gothic tradition, but there are still vestiges of earlier Gothic in his works.
Lovecraft often does get kind of tied into the Gothic, regardless of whether his work actually fits specifically within those themes. Why do they feel so closely tied?
Well, I see in Lovecraft's works certainly a preoccupation with horror and terror, you know, both. In At the Mountains of Madness, he describes a sublime landscape, and the ancient city that he discovers is described as being, you know, almost beyond description, hard to fathom. So he's concerned with sublimity and terror because there's a lot of uncertainty throughout that novella about what the threat actually is. That's only revealed close to the end. But then there's also horror, you know, the description of the mangled bodies of the dead explorers. And we also see in Lovecraft, you know, interestingly, some, again, vestiges of first wave Gothic, of 18th century Gothic. The explorers at one point are, they have flashlights and they're worried that the batteries are going to die, kind of like that convention of the Gothic heroine traveling through the castle, worried about her candle being extinguished. So, but it is, he's a wonderful, wonderfully strange horror writer.
When talking about the kind of the games that we're looking at, we had one creator who specifically cited Herman Melville and Edgar Allan Poe, mm-hmm. and those kinds of works, while another said that he drew most of his influence out of The Shadow of Innsmouth, being one of the early Lovecraftian novellas. What are the kind of nuances that can be found that mark those as different from each other?
Do you know, to be quite frank, I see a lot of parallels. I mean, Edgar Allan Poe, to just use the example of Poe and Lovecraft, do have their very distinct styles, but there is a lot of influence there. And I would say that, you know, Lovecraft wouldn't have existed had it not been for Poe. So if you look at, for example, at the Mountain of Madness, Mountains of Madness, it's very much influenced by Arthur Gordon Pym, the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, you know, which is also a, kind of a cautionary tale. It's a story of, it's a fantastic adventure story about adventures at sea. That includes a lot of the same themes. And as a matter of fact, Lovecraft alludes to Poe in his story. So I would say there are more continuities than differences between those two writers.
What would be then the nuances between them? How could you then identify a Poe story as opposed to one focused on a more cosmic terror?
That's a really good question. I think that Poe might be more concerned with the criminal behaviors of human beings. I'm thinking about, you know, texts like The Cask of the Amontillado or The Black Cat and focusing on, a protagonist who, you know, showing the world from the distorted point of view of a madman, of the gothic villain, basically. Whereas perhaps Lovecraft, certainly in At the Mountains of Madness, concerned with more cosmic horrors, horrors that are in some sense more sublime and more difficult to articulate.
Why then the one thing that kind of you mentioned on both sides is this theme of madness and mental health. Mm-hmm. Why the focus then on that kind of psychological horror?
Well, I think that Gothic has always been interested in, you know, character interiority. And again, it gets back to that reaction against the Enlightenment and, you know, characters who are experiencing extreme emotions. But the preoccupation with insanity seems to grow with the genre. And, for example, at the Mountains of Madness, we have... it's a first person narrator, Dyer, who is really an unreliable narrator, and we question throughout whether what he describes is in fact, and he describes finding beyond the Mountains of Madness this ancient city populated by these strange creatures, the Elder Ones, who are 8 feet tall and have tentacles and star shaped heads and so on. And the other members of his companions, except for one graduate student, are all killed horribly by these creatures. And, you know, and that's quite horrifying. But really what's most horrifying about the story, I think, is our suspicion that perhaps the narrator is insane and that, you know, we can't trust his account.
When... the times that these stories are coming out, there is kind of this big separation between, no one really understands what madness is, if it's a disease, if it's a social malignancy. How did that then, the kind of psychology of the time, inform the ways these stories were written, would you say, like, based on your knowledge?
It's a really good question. I do think, always Gothic has been interested in extreme emotions, but as the field of psychology develops, that we see that reflected in literature.
Now, in a lot of these these stories, the enemy isn't often 100% beatable, or the hero is never 100% victorious. Mm-hmm. But these are very popular stories and ones that have really stuck with us. Why do you think we have this romance with a dreadful foe?
That's such a good question. And isn't it true that the scariest foes are those that are hard to even detect or hard to confront, you know? And that's certainly the case in a story like At the Mountains of Madness by Lovecraft, and where the foe is not so easily identified. And for that reason, and that's where a lot of the terror of the text comes from. But I think, you know, the thing about Gothic is... one of my favorite definitions of Gothic is by a Gothic scholar called Eve Sedgwick, and she defines Gothic as an aesthetic based on pleasurable fear. So on the one hand, we have, Gothic as the expression of cultural and personal anxieties, fears about death, fears about loss of control, fears about losing control over our bodies or our minds. But there's also a lot of pleasure in Gothic narrative, and I'm sure it's the same for Gothic video games as well, because they're fantasies. And there's that vicarious participation in the adventures of the hero, even as he confronts the, or she confronts the foes and you know, tries to overcome the different challenges. And it's all with an aesthetic distance, right? So we're seeing violence and we're seeing horror, but from the safe, you know, comfort of our desk chairs or our armchairs.
As someone who teaches this subject, have you seen interest in classes around Gothic fiction increase or wane over the last decade?
Increase, definitely increase. I think there's been, you know, and really Gothic has only been taught in a formal way in universities for the past, you know, a couple of decades, and the field of Gothic scholarship really only took hold in the past couple of decades. But it's becoming increasingly popular. Whenever a Gothic course is offered at York, where I teach, or you know, here at Ryerson, it fills up right away. And I think it really speaks to the students' fascination with, and all of our fascination with, the unknown, and you know, those that's at the center of Gothic narrative.
Do you think there's anything with the kind of current preoccupation or current malaise that there seems to be this nihilistic tendency amongst people these days that might be charging this renewed interest?
Possibly. That's really interesting. I would link it to certain, you know, actual events like, for example, 9/11. I would say after 9/11, we see an interest in these kinds of narratives. And they, you know, and I think that just reflects a culture of fear, of uncertainty, literally terror. And so I would say that that's, you know, the early 21st century sort of marked a new period in Gothic.
It's kind of funny that the thing that precedes Lovecraft is World War One, which is also initiated by an act of terror, and now that we see this kind of resurgence is also this big 9/11. What about these acts of violence in particular, you think ties into the Gothic and the Lovecraftian?
That's really insightful. And I would add too that you know, there's a flourishing of Gothic around the time of the French Revolution. So when we go back and think about first wave Gothic, and in many ways you can see those early Gothic tales of horror and terror as being as sort of metaphorically dealing with the horrors of, you know, or the reign of terror and the things that were going on, you know, the British novels dealing with the things that were going on in France. So yes, it's about art working through cultural traumas and getting back to this idea that Gothic is always about the expression of contemporary anxieties. And, you know, that it is a way for us to deal with our fears, to deal with our anxieties at sort of aesthetically. And reading Gothic is always, you know, there's something cathartic. And I imagine it's the same with Gothic video games as well.
Gothic has, as we mentioned, have kind of gone through a bunch of waves. When has the reaction of the readers been, have there been parallels through them throughout these different eras, through the French Revolution, through the Victorian, through now, that kind of the ways that they were responded to? I imagine that as the Gothic first emerged, it must have been quite different from anything that came before it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, anytime you say that something is new, you can always find precursors. So, you know, the Gothic tales do have their earlier influences, you know, in fairy tales, for example, which are a lot more dark and, one might say, Gothic than we usually think, or, you know, chivalric romances and so on. So there have always been tales of horror and terror. But yes, it emerges in the 18th century as a genre, as a recognizable literary form, and was always enormously popular. And that's the thing about Gothic narrative. It's popular. It's sometimes stigmatized for that reason. It's got a mass appeal, but at the same time, it's usually disparaged by critics. And that's something that continues from the Romantic period right to today, where there's always been a fear that those who consume Gothic narratives will not be able to distinguish between the Gothic fantasies and reality and will somehow lose themselves in that imaginative process. And that's something that continues even to today, you know, in discourse about violence in the media, in horror films, in video games, that, you know, first-person shooter games, for example, that the consumer won't be able to differentiate between what's fiction and what's real. And the violence and the horrors in Gothic will desensitize them to real horrors.
And at the same time, it's kind of seen as trashy. I mean, you look at those old books and they're seen as like, oh, those are, you buy a book for $5 and maybe you get some fun out of it, but it's not real literature.
Absolutely.
Where does that element of the stigmatization come from?
Yeah, that's true. And Michael Gamer, another really important critic of Gothic, says that you cannot understand Gothic literature without confronting its cultural stigma. So he also recognizes the stigma, to use your word, of Gothic as being a defining quality. And yes, it's always been popular. Getting back to Lovecraft and his choice to publish in pulp magazines, and it's always been disparaged for that reason, considered commercial, and rather than literary, so to speak. But of course, that's rather false distinction, because you look at some examples of Gothic literature, and they're among, you know, the classics of English literature. Look at the Brontes, you know, for example. And I would say if you take someone like Lovecraft or Poe, I mean, they're such expert writers. And so that distinction, even though Gothic is always sort of put into the category as of low and popular, lowbrow, maybe to make it less threatening, in fact, it's not really necessarily a reflection on the quality of the writing.
What about your own fascination? What drove you to study the occult?
Do you know what's rather funny? I actually came to Gothic through parodies of Gothic. So I read Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen, which is a romantic period parody. It's a satire on Gothic readers. So the heroine, Catherine Morland, had her head turned by reading too many Anne Radcliffe novels. And I really thought it was a charming book, but it introduced me to Gothic. So after reading Northanger Abbey, I went and read Anne Radcliffe, the Gothic novels that Catherine Morland had been so fascinated with. And then, you know, I discovered this genre. And I sort of worked my way from early Gothic, you know, Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole, and then found Victorian Gothic, and then, 20th century Gothic.
If you were going to hallmark specific books for maybe new readers to get into TV, film, what would you say are hallmarks throughout perhaps the early wave, the Victorian and contemporary that you'd highlight?
Oh, it's so hard because I have so many favorites. However, you have to start with Horace Walpole's Castle of Otranto, 1764, because it is considered the first Gothic novel. And the genre gets its name really from that book, because it's set in Gothic times, in medieval times, and we've got the Gothic castle, Gothic heroine, the patriarchal villain, ghosts, all of the trappings, the accoutrements of Gothic are introduced. It's a blueprint for the genre. So you have to start with Castle of Otranto. And then you should read Matthew Lewis's The Monk, which is another example of first wave Gothic, a story about a monk's moral descent, and he ends up murdering his mother and doing all sorts of other dreadful things. I won't ruin it for the listeners. Anne Radcliffe and the Brontes, once we move into the Victorian period. I'm partial to vampire fiction, and I think J.S. Le Fanu's Carmilla is a wonderful vampire novel from the Victorian period. It's a landmark vampire fiction. Le Fanu is an Irish writer, and it's a story about a female vampire, Carmilla. But there's a lot of lesbian subtext to the work. So we have her attacking Laura, the protagonist. It's a really interesting work. And from there, you know, you can read Bram Stoker's Dracula, if you haven't already, and compare it. Once we get into the 20th century, Lovecraft is who you have to read, I think. And then Stephen King is someone I'm quite partial to as well.
The short stories or novels, would you say would be a better entry point?
I would say both, because they're very different, because a novel can do something that a short story can't do. If you want to read Gothic short stories, Poe is who you need to read, because he was the master of that short form. And there's a greater concision there, a tightness of focus, fewer characters, and so on. In the novels, like an Anne Radcliffe novel, for example, you have more development. You can extend the story, greater suspense, and greater development of plots and intricacies. So really, they're just very different forms of Gothic expression.
I'd like to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.